The book of Habakkuk is probably my favorite of all the minor prophets. So I've got a lot of favorites I love, but this book holds a special place in my heart. I suppose I first started turning my heart toward it about 20 years ago. About 20 years ago, last month, my father had a massive heart attack. On the way to the hospital, I was following behind the ambulance. On the way to the hospital, they pulled over and stopped. My heart stopped. I was terrified. Because I know they don't just pull over unless there's a reason. Eventually, the hospital started up again and made its way back to the ambulance started up again and made its way back to the hospital. And it had only stopped just a few blocks away. That's why I was even more concerned. I later found out that my father flatlined while he was in the ambulance. I was very close to losing him. I thank God every day that my father survived. Years later, my dad and I were having a conversation about that day and about what led up to it and what happened to him the days afterwards. And we got to talking, and my father was a hog farmer. If you don't know what that means you don't get a break. Hog farmers work when the hogs need them. If it's cold outside, he has to make certain the lines don't freeze. If they're hungry, he has to feed them. When he had his heart attack, it was a year that the hog market crashed about 20 years ago. My dad's responsibilities were to remove every hog from the farm. He had to sell them all off. My dad had grown quite fond of the hogs. They were his second family. I was a bit disturbed by that, but they were his second family. And I sometimes wonder if he loved them more than he loved me. But it's another story. But he actually had put in that last year, 100-hour weeks, that felt like. He would come home, he would eat supper, and he'd go back to work, and he wouldn't come home until supper time again, over and over again. I remember watching my dad fall asleep in a plate full of spaghetti, but he continued to go to work because the job had to be done. He told me in the midst of all of this, he couldn't take anymore. So he began praying, and he asked God for a break. The next day, he had a heart attack. He then began praying more specifically. I don't just want a break. And he always warned me that when I pray, be specific about what I pray for, because sometimes what God gives us, it isn't exactly what we were looking for. The story of Habakkuk begins that way. And that's why it became one of my favorites when I was younger. And the more that I have studied it, the more I have loved this book. If you were to talk to my wife, she knows how much I love this book, because when she got pregnant the fifth time, the one that we lost, I was begging her to name our child Habakkuk if it was a boy. She said over her dead body. She says, I'm not sending my kid through life with that name. But I love his story. And I wanted to honor him in some way in my home. And so I do. I am mindful about what I pray for. And I try to help myself remember every day Habakkuk's story because of how it ends. For me, the ending of the story is one of the most powerful stories in all the Bible. And I realize that's my personal opinion, but for me it speaks volumes. And I wanted to share with you the story of Habakkuk so that you can appreciate perhaps a little bit of the way that I appreciate this remarkable story. To understand Habakkuk, I first want us to begin with understanding a little bit of the historical context. Habakkuk was likely the last prophet God sent to Israel before the destruction of Jerusalem by Babylon. Most place the timeline of his prophecy after the destruction of Nineveh, but before the first captives were taken from Jerusalem, of which Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were. And that puts us right around 611, 605, right around there, BC, depending on whose timeline you're using. This would have made him a contemporary with people like Zephaniah and Jeremiah. This also means that there was great political unrest in the east. With the death of Ashurbanipal in 633, Assyria was permanently weakened. He was the last of the great kings of the Assyrian Empire. If you spent any kind of time studying them, you would know how miserable of a people they really were. They were not a good people to be considered your enemy. But with his death, they began to weaken. And Assyria began to lose its grips on other kingdoms in their land, Babylon and Judah being among these. As Assyria weakened, Nabopolassar, father of Nebuchadnezzar, declared Babylon's freedom. And this naturally led to war because Assyria couldn't just let someone declare their freedom. Typically, the Assyrians would have squashed the Babylonians. But with the Medes and the Persians growing in strength, the Assyrian army was stretched too thin. And by 614, the Medes had captured the city of Asshur, a chief city of Assyria, and Babylon destroyed Nineveh 2 years later. The Egyptians came to Assyria's aid in Haran, the last stronghold of Assyria, and this is when Josiah rode out to battle to stop the Egyptians. He died as a result of it because God told him not to go. After Josiah's death, you know the stories, and I remember the pictures when I was growing up as a kid. The smiling faces meant the good kings, and the frown faces meant the bad kings. Josiah was the last smiling face. There were no more good kings in Israel after him. I named one of my sons Josiah for a reason. I love that story. But his children were not great. His son Jehoahaz was made king, and he lasted only 3 months before Pharaoh Necho removed him from office and placed his brother Jehoiakim on the throne of David. Both of Josiah's boys did evil in the sight of God. And it was Jehoiakim who was king when Habakkuk prophesied. That's the context in which we find this prophecy. And when Habakkuk begins speaking unto God, the beginning of chapter 1, he begins telling him all that's wrong in Judah. Look with me here, beginning in verse 2. He says, O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, but you will not hear? Or cry to you violence, and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity? And why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. He's saying unto God, why aren't you doing something about this? Can you not see the things that Israel is doing? Your people, who are supposed to be your people, a people of love and justice and mercy, and they're not that. Violence was in the city of Jerusalem. In verse 4, it tells us specifically that violence was witnessed by the oppression of the righteous. Rather than seeing the wicked suffering because of their wickedness, the court system had become so corrupted that the wicked were celebrating as the poor and the righteous were suffering. It was not just the physical suffering of justice was not on their side for those who were righteous, but the emotional suffering as they continued to see the wicked thrive in the land. He tells us also in verse 4 that the law was being ignored. Unlike the days of Manasseh and Ammon when the book of the law was lost, he's telling us they ignored it. It's not that they lost it and they could say, well, I really didn't know. Josiah can make that argument. Hey, I didn't know. He's saying they do know and they don't care. They just ignored it. The law says, honor the Sabbath. And they say, I'm going to go work on Saturday. The law says that we are to honor a mother and father. And they say, I don't care. I'm not going to listen to my mom and dad. They say we need to make certain that we do not covet our neighbor's possessions. The Bible says that. And the people are saying, that's okay. I'm going to not only covet, but I'm going to take my neighbor's possessions. I'm going to take my neighbor's wife. They ignored the law. They didn't care what it said. No one was listening to the priests or the prophets, not Nahum, not Habakkuk, not Jeremiah, not Zephaniah. They spoke to those who were more interested in what they wanted as opposed to what God wanted. And justice was never upheld. I remember a teacher, one of my teachers in high school, who once told me to never speak in absolutes because there's always the exception. When God speaks in absolutes, there's no exception. God didn't make a mistake. We have an inspired writer saying that there is no justice. It was never upheld. Things were so bad that justice was never served. The wicked were never punished. The righteous were never upheld. I want you to think about that for just a moment. Could you imagine living in a world where every time you tried to do the right thing, you were punished for it? Imagine living in a world that if you tried to gather together, like tonight, and to be able to gather together and worship God in the manner that God has commanded us, to have that freedom stripped away from us. And if they found out that we were here, they were kicking the doors in and dragging us out, calling us the wicked people for breaking their version of the law. That's the kind of world that they were living in. Look back at how they treated Jeremiah. Jeremiah was so unwelcome, it got to the point he couldn't even step foot inside of the city of Jerusalem. And to make matters worse, Jeremiah was of the priestly line, which means his family of priests didn't want him around. Things were not good in Jerusalem. Could you imagine living in a world that they released every prisoner in all the prisons and in all the jails in our country? I told them to go home. Go do whatever you want. We'll not arrest you again. Justice is never served. Habakkuk was carrying a great burden, and it was intensified by what he perceived as God's lack of interference. While the scriptures do not let us know how long Habakkuk had asked God to bring justice, it was long enough that Habakkuk thought that God wasn't doing anything. So you kind of put that in perspective. How many times do you have to pray over your thorn in the flesh before you start feeling like God's not listening? It's usually not the first time, is it? So we've been praying for a while that we're struggling with something. We feel like nothing's being done. That's when we start asking the question, how much longer do I have to go through this? Again, I don't know how long he's been praying, but I know he's been praying long enough to feel that God isn't listening. Habakkuk views his lack of action by God, as we see here in verse 3, as a way of teaching me a lesson. Why do you make me see iniquity? You think, well, maybe God is doing this for a purpose. Maybe God is wanting me to see all of this stuff. But you don't understand why. Why are you making me see this? Why do I have to constantly witness this wickedness and oppression among your people? There have been times where I felt like offering similar prayers as I look in the world around us today. Regretfully, I don't get the exact answer that God gets, that God gives here. God speaks directly into Habakkuk. And it's one of the things that makes me love this story. Because like Jonah, it's more about the conversation between God and one of his people than it is about the prophetic message. I understand the prophetic message is important, but I think revealing unto us this prophetic message doesn't carry the weight that it would because we have books like Jeremiah that spend a great deal of time talking about what God is going to do. Habakkuk is a short book, but I think it tells us a whole lot more about what God's expectation is of his people, his righteous people, in the time of oppression. And so God answers beginning in verse 5, and he says, look among the nations and see and wonder and be astounded, for I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if you were told. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation who march to the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome, and their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. God said it was going to be a surprising move. I mentioned earlier about how my dad said be specific about what you're asking for. He asked God to deal with this, and God says, okay, I'm going to. We're going to send the Chaldeans. We're going to find out that Habakkuk didn't like that answer. The Chaldeans were going to come. The Chaldeans were going to deal with this issue. And I imagine God says it was going to be surprising. I think part of that is because Josiah assisted the Babylonians. This was supposed to be a brotherhood relationship. Why would they rise up against their ally? But that's exactly what they were going to do. Ultimately, they were doing it because God was sending them, and the destruction be swift and fierce. To understand the Babylonians, I mentioned the Assyrians were horrible people. The Babylonians were even worse. The Babylonians were despicable. We talked about some of the things which they did when we discussed earlier some of the prophets from him earlier this week, but the Babylonians were known for just completely annihilating a people. They were hasty in their destruction. They were bloodthirsty, just like the Assyrians were. They were more like a brother and sister nation than that of any others I could see in the ancient Near East. They were two peas in a pod. I remember listening to one person describe their bloodthirstiness when I was in college. And one of my professors in college, and just this image stuck in my head, that it was not uncommon for them to cut the heads off of their rulers, stick them on spikes, and hang them in their gardens. It's like, wow, that they'd be eating their dinner next to a fallen king. And there was head sitting there anyways. They were despicable people. Sure, we know a little bit about them as we read through the book of Daniel, and their leaders were hot-headed, ready to destroy in an instant. You're not going to bow down before my king, we'll toss you into the fire. And because he was angry enough, he turned the fire up so hot, killed his own people. But he was that set on making sure Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego died. He was a prideful man, Nebuchadnezzar was. And that's how he led his nation. Habakkuk wasn't exactly thrilled to hear that this was going to take place. And he says here in verse 12, "You not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One. We shall not die, O Lord. You have ordained them as a judgment, and you look, and you, O rock, have established them for reproof. You are of a purer eyes than us to see evil and cannot look at wrong. Why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked and swallows up the man more right, the man more righteous than he?" And so he's staying here. He's like, wait a minute, God. I get it. You're going to punish wickedness, but why are you using someone worse than we are? Why is the one who was less righteous doing the punishing here? He didn't like the answer that God gave. He continues to describe his unappreciation of God's answer. How could he use a wicked nation like this to punish Israel? I mean, he knew God was a righteous God. He starts that by calling him a judge, a rock. He calls him holy, everlasting, and pure. He has every reason to trust in God, but God's story, God's vision, God's message troubles him deeply because of the wickedness of the Babylonians. He says in verse 16, "Therefore he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet, for by them he lives in luxury and his food is rich. They are never full," he tells us in verse 17. "Is it he that is to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever?" So you see what he's describing there? He's describing this pulley across this dragnet across the bottom. And so they gather up whatever it is, sludge and whatever it is, and grab up upon the bottom, and they dump it into the boat, and they immediately go back again. And they drag it across the bottom, and they dump it in the boat, and they go back again because they're never satisfied. They have to keep gathering and keep gathering and keep plundering and keep destroying because their nets are never going to be full enough. Mercilessly, as he says here, killing nations forever. That does not mean without end. That just means that Habakkuk couldn't see the end because they're never satisfied. He was describing the nature of these people. They're bloodthirsty, just like the Assyrians, and they won't stop. Despite his understandings of who the Babylonians were, he failed to have a grasp on who God is. He had trouble harmonizing how a righteous God could use a wicked nation to accomplish his will. And you know, I think part of that is because man tends to categorize sins in levels. Where he said that how could you use a more wicked man destroy the righteous? Well, he wasn't really calling them righteous. He was saying, we're more righteous than they are. Remember how he described them? Justice is never served. Violence is always here. And the guy says, okay, I'm destroying with the Chaldeans. He says, wait a minute, God. They're worse than we are. Says who? Says a man. You see, we have a long history, man does, a long history of thinking that because we're not as bad as somebody else, we're okay. I mean, if that's how we're going to compare ourselves, why not just start at the bottom of the barrel, right? Well, thank goodness we're not like Charles Manson, right? Is that how we're going to stand before God? When he's opening up the book and he said, Wes, you did this, you did this. Wait, God, wait. But I'm not Charles Manson. I'm not Adolf Hitler here. Is that how that's going to work? We start at the bottom of the barrel and say, well, we're not as bad as that. And you think, well, everybody's like, well, yeah, Wes, that's a little bit of a hyperbole. No one's actually saying that. No, what we actually end up saying is what Jesus condemned people for saying. Yeah, but didn't I, like, cast out demons in your name and do many wonderful things in your name? And yet Jesus says, depart from me, workers of iniquity. Why? Because we're trying to judge our righteousness in our own eyes. In God's eyes, sin condemns us. It still blows my mind when I turn over to Revelation chapter 21 and verse 7. I see listed in their sins like murder. I see in their adultery, and I see in their idolatry, and I see in their sorcery, and that's like really bad stuff. And then it throws in there like all liars. Really? Like all of them? Are you sure? Like every liar. And that's what God said. All of them. Well, what about the lies I say to protect, you know, my relationship with my spouse? No, God said all of them. What about the lies I tell my children to protect their innocence? No, God said all of them. All lies. And then to top it off, he also puts in there the cowardly. Those who are afraid. They're cast in the lake of fire. And if those who are just afraid, he didn't say they went out and did a whole bunch of horrible things. Maybe they were too afraid to stand up and do the right thing when they saw injustice taking place. The children in the audience, that can mean like you're seeing someone bullied at school and you don't say anything because you're afraid. That doesn't make God happy. God wants you to say something. He wants us to stand up for justice. I remember that happened to my daughter last year. The school decided to do a walkout. We're going to walk out of school in an anti-gun march. And my daughter suggested that maybe instead of walking out, we should walk over to those people we've been bullying and apologize. They told her she was stupid and it wouldn't work. And they began bullying her as a result of it. She was okay. She was discouraged that people would think that way, but she wasn't, you know, wrecked in her soul, so to speak. But that's what we need to be doing, to stand up when we see injustice done. Habakkuk failed to realize that all of that stuff made them just as bad as the one doing the really bad stuff. They were wicked because they sinned. Paul would write it this way in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 10, or as many are the works of the law are written under it, under the curse, for it is written, cursed is everyone that continues not in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them. It means if we're cutting out part of it, and we say, well, we're cutting it out, or we're failing to do it, or we ignore it, or however it is, God says you're cursed. There's no salvation for those who refuse to do the will of God. We cannot pinpoint the things that we're doing right and say, well, I've not done that. So Habakkuk carried a great burden. The first caused by his lack of patience to allow God to do his work in his time. And the second burden was caused by a lack of understanding of what makes one righteous. More importantly, he could not understand why God would choose this method. And his prayer in chapter 3 brings this out even more. And we'll discuss that here in just a few minutes. But after Habakkuk said these things about questioning, you know, kind of questioning God here, God responds to him in chapter 2, beginning in verse 4. And as far as I can tell, this is the first prophecy against the young nation of Babylon. They would remain a world power for just 66 years. This prophecy was spoken about 70 years prior to its fall. And God condemns Babylon for a variety of sins. In verse 4, he says that they were full of pride. In verse 5, he recognizes they were never satisfied with war. Verse 8, he says they looted many nations. In verse 9, he says they gained by evil means. In verse 12, he says they built a city with bloodshed. Verse 17, he again mentions their violence, as if never being satisfied with war and building a city of bloodshed doesn't pinpoint that clear enough. And then he also mentions their idolatry in verse 18. As a result of this, God began easing the burden that was placed upon Habakkuk. He eased the first by explaining the judgment was coming swiftly on the people of Israel. And then he eased the second burden by explaining that Babylon would also be punished for their wickedness. And then that carries us over to chapter 3 and Habakkuk's final prayer. Most of this prayer further explains why Habakkuk trusts in God. He spends the first 15 verses praising God and talking about his might, his worth, his power. And I'm just mesmerized by this. He doesn't agree with what God is doing in that he's using a nation that he's very uncomfortable with coming down to Jerusalem. And I think the biggest reason for that, maybe the best way to describe it, a way we could understand it, it's kind of like the bull in the china shop. The bull gets in the china shop. How do you keep it from breaking everything? You kind of can't, can you? It's just going to wreck stuff. There might be stuff that survives, but there's no way of controlling what does survive. And until the bull gets out, you just have the mess on your hands. And then you go through and you kind of weed through it and figure out what survived. And that's the kind of way that Babylon was. They would come into an area and they would just wreck it. And there was no way of controlling, in Habakkuk's mind, their destruction. It was just a swath through it like a locust plague that comes through and destroys everything in its path, and then maybe something survives. I think he was showing a concern about how God was going to make certain that Israel wasn't completely destroyed. How can you assure that this is going to happen? And so he begins with this amazing prayer of praising God and telling God how powerful and wonderful and all of these things. And I love the language that he uses here. He talks about God, the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor has covered the heavens, the earth with full of praise. Verse 4, his brightness was the light. Rays flashed from his hand, and there his veiled his power. Before him went pestilence and plague followed at his heels. He is describing God as the one who can do what he wants, when he wants, and how he wants. And he's not saying I should be afraid of that, but praise God that that's the kind of God that I serve. Praise God that that's the kind of God that I am trusting in right now. Because when we come to the last four verses of the book of Habakkuk, his language changes. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor the fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on the high places. As I've read this through the years, I often tear up, sorry. This is so huge and powerful. Israel had fallen into sin. It was idolatry, perverted justice. The righteous were being oppressed. Habakkuk has been crying out for a while that God does something, and God says, this is what I'm going to do. And what I find fascinating about Habakkuk is how unlike it is the prophets of his time. Let me explain what I mean by that. When you read through Jeremiah, you read through Zephaniah, you study those books, you'll find a very, as well as some of the other minor prophets, a very common theme keeps coming up. The remnant. The remnant that God will allow to survive. You know what you don't find in Habakkuk? A remnant. God says, I'm sending the Babylonians. They're going to take care of the mess in Jerusalem. And then I'll take care of the Babylonians. He doesn't say, well, I'm going to preserve my righteous people. Something else I find fascinating about Habakkuk, especially compared to that of Jeremiah. You know the story of Jeremiah. You know that God told Jeremiah, I'm going to keep you safe. He told Jeremiah he would survive the captivity. And we know as you read through the story of Jeremiah, he does. The captivity is carried off, and he was kind of carried off initially, but allowed to return before they got all the way to Babylon. And he returns back down to Jerusalem. He prophesies again there. And while in Jerusalem, we find even the stories of him going down to Egypt, which he told them not to do, but he traveled with them because he was supposed to be with God's people. Jeremiah was told he would survive, and it showed him surviving. You know what Habakkuk was told about his survival? Nothing. Not a word. Habakkuk said, God, I need you to do something. I'm seeing all of this oppression. And I just can't take it anymore. My eyes cannot take this wickedness a day longer. And so God says, I'm going to send the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, one and the same, in case you were wondering why I switched them back and forth. It's the same nation. I'm going to send them to deal with Israel, and then I'll deal with them when they're done. And he says, okay. Even if it means every tree is gone, and every field is destroyed, and every vineyard eliminated, that there are no animals left after this monster of a nation comes through here, he says, God, you're my salvation. Mentioned earlier that my dad said to be specific about what you pray for because sometimes you don't get what you're asking for. I guarantee you this was not what Habakkuk wanted. Habakkuk wanted, maybe he wanted God to send fire down from heaven and just consume the wicked. I don't know what he was looking for, but you know what? There is a precedent for it, Sodom and Gomorrah, right? I don't know what he was looking for. But I know this wasn't what he was looking for. And God says, this is exactly what I'm going to do. And he doesn't go, God, it's unfair. Have we ever said that when prayers don't get answered the way that we want? It's not fair. It's not what he did. He said, okay. God, it's in your hands. And I'm going to trust you to do whatever it is you need to do to be just and holy and righteous. I know a lot of times we like looking at the prayer of Jesus. And I realize the prayer of Jesus probably says it a lot more beautifully. But at the end of his prayer in the garden, he says, not my will, but yours be done. That's the same thing Habakkuk is saying. And I can tell you right now, it's a whole lot easier to say those words. It's a lot harder to live them. I want to be just like Habakkuk, though. And I want you to as well. To be able to trust in God when your whole world comes crashing down around you. And you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. And maybe you convince yourself there is no light at the end of this tunnel. Be able to go to God in prayer and say, you are the God of my salvation. And that no matter what happens, I will never stop trusting in you. God wants you to trust him like that. He wants you to honor him. He wants you to love him. He wants you to give yourself fully over to him, just like Habakkuk did. But I know that does not happen that easily. I know that because I struggle with this all the time. There have been many times where I said in my prayer, God, your will be done and not mine. But the reality was I was thinking, I really hope it's mine. I don't need to do that. The first step, I promise you, is the hardest, though. If you're not yet a child of God, I'm not saying it's easy to admit your faults, but I can promise you your life will be easier if you begin placing your life in the hands of God. Because you have a Father who loves you and who will never turn his back on you, and he will never give up on you. If you've not yet been a child of God, I encourage you to do so before you leave here tonight. If you've already become a child of God and you've stopped trusting in God and you want to ask forgiveness in a public way, we grant you that opportunity. Whatever that need might be, if there's some way which myself or the elders here can help you, one of these sitting in the pew here in front of me, who together we stand and sing the song that's been selected.